Welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. Today is March 6, 2024, and I'm Jay Caspian Kang, here with my co-host, Tyler Austin Harper. How's it going, Tyler?
It's going great, Jay. I'm particularly excited about today's topic. We're diving into the complex and ever-evolving world of artificial intelligence. It's a subject that touches just about every facet of our lives these days.
Absolutely, Tyler. From how we work, learn, and even how we interact with each other, AI has become a foundational element of modern existence. But with its rapid development and integration into our daily lives, there's a lot to unpack regarding its benefits, challenges, and the ethical dilemmas it poses.
That's right. And today, we're not shying away from any of it. We'll explore how AI is reshaping industries, the way it's influencing creative processes, and its impact on privacy and personal freedoms. It's a topic that's as fascinating as it is important to understand.
To help us navigate these waters, we've invited some leading thinkers and practitioners in the field of artificial intelligence. They'll share their insights on where AI technology is heading, its societal implications, and what it all might mean for the future of humanity.
Whoops. Okay, I didn't mean that to go again. For those who couldn't tell, I did a little experiment because this week we are talking about AI. We do have an expert on, my friend, Ben Recht. He has been on the show before. Ben, say hello to everyone. This is not his AI voice, even though I did ask him to record an AI recording or like a script so that I could look through all of this. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. I knew it was a trap.
So what you heard was, all right, I had an intensive process there. I had ChatGPT-4, right, whatever the most recent one is, and I said, make a Time to Say Goodbye podcast episode about AI, right? And these are the names of the two hosts. It spat up something really stupid. And so I said, like, make it a little bit more spicy, right? And then that's basically what it came up with. And then I have this program called Descript where you can read a script in your voice, and then it's like a podcast editing thing. And so, like, the idea is that if you forgot to introduce, let's say, the guest on the podcast and you don't feel like re-recording it, you can take both of your voices and just slide in like, oh, today our guest is so-and-so. Anyway, so that is a completely generated AI podcast. Tyler is here too, as was introduced. I don't know, what'd you guys think about my AI artwork?
It was crazy, man. Really disturbing. I also can't imagine wanting to use that to like correct an error in a podcast. Like, I forgot to do this thing, so I'm just gonna have, yeah, I don't know. But it was crazy.
Yeah. Ben, what did you think?
It's funny because you could hear all the quirks that you would expect, where it like doesn't know how to end sentences.
Yeah.
Like, syntax, so if you know what's coming, you're like, yeah. But it's, you know, obviously way better than it used to be.
Keep getting better.
That's what the AI guys keep telling me.
It did kind of sound like me if I was like
on Quaaludes.
Yeah, I was gonna say on like some very weird combination of drugs. I think I would sound that way. One of them would probably be Quaaludes, right? And then it would have to be something both disassociative but also energizing in a way where I felt like talking that much, right? The other thing I noticed that I thought was very funny was, did you notice the way in which ChatGPT thinks about the AI industry? Because I found that to be totally fascinating. There was no prompt in there that was like, and make AI sound like it's awesome. It was just like, let's just do an episode about AI. Did you guys catch that?
Yeah, I totally did like a little propaganda thing.
Yeah, it's like, now that it is a foundational part of every industry in America, we must discuss the ethical dilemmas. I don't know. I found it to be kind of interesting. I felt like it was kind of impressive, but yeah, maybe Descript is a bad program or something. Cause I've heard better.
Yeah.
I've heard better voice versions. And obviously I only did this once, but I think there's ways in which you can keep feeding it and feeding it, and then it'll get a little bit better.
Yeah. I think that it's hard to keep track of these things. Cause I know, you know, that kind of thing, for if you were willing to spend long enough time with one person, you could generate a single person's voice like 20 years ago. I think the thing that's wild now is just anybody can do this. Now it's totally. Now it's just commodity. And even with, so what, I don't know what Descript is. Do they charge you a lot of money?
No, it's pretty cheap. It's actually, in some ways, it's a good program, but I would say that, Descript people, if you're listening to the podcast, I will say the idea of it is very cool, but the actual execution of it is like kind of garbage. What it does is you feed it an audio file and it punts out a transcript, and you can just read the transcript and you can cut out every word that you don't like in the transcript, and it automatically cuts it out of the audio file. So if you're editing a podcast, it's a lot easier to just scroll through, find the parts that you remember were like either boring or lacking in some sort of way, cut those out. It even does this thing that I've used once, but it made it so difficult to listen to that I didn't do it again, where you can remove every filler word. So every sort of, whatever filler word that you use, it'll just cut it all, out. Yeah. But then it sounds crazy.
You squish them together?
Yeah. They haven't gotten the thing where they can like, there should be some way where in the waveform, I would imagine, right? You would imagine, oh, that was super abrupt. And like it does kind of signal bad transitions in the script, but it doesn't auto fix it yet. Yeah. And that would be super impressive if they could do that because, as somebody who says the words like much more than I would like to, and as somebody who has worked on that unsuccessfully in his professional life, it would be incredibly helpful to have something like that, but it's not quite there.
Yeah.
And then they added on, of course, a bunch of stupid AI bells and whistles at some point. They're like, Descript now has AI, and what you heard is
it's pretty funny. Everybody has AI. Slack has AI. I don't know why anybody wants that, but it doesn't matter. I'm sure it's only a matter of time before we get AI. I guess Apple already has AI on all their dumb iPhone apps, right? It's everywhere, man.
It's like when everything added the blockchain. It's the same exact thing. I mean, although maybe a little bit more productive in the blockchain, which most things, like almost everything, doesn't need the blockchain. In fact, it's hard to find one thing that needs blockchain. But AI, I don't know. I guess I could, whatever you want to define it as, I guess we can see it. Anyway, we didn't have you on, Ben, just to talk about our little experiment in Descript and AI fake podcasting, or else we would have just done the fake podcast. Ben is a professor at UC Berkeley of, remind me again, electrical engineering and with a specialty in machine learning. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the department's the electrical engineering and computer sciences.
Okay.
It's a historical thing because that was when it started, when electrical engineering was more important than computer sciences. And the balance of power has shifted. So the computer science people don't like to tell you that, they would really like the EE to be removed. But that's all right. Long-standing academic battles that no one cares about.
It sounds cooler.
I'm sure your peers care.
It sounds cooler, I think. Electrical engineering.
I think electrical engineering is awesome, man. Yeah, I love electrical engineering. it's one of those funny things. It's actually related to this. Maybe what I was going to bring up today. It's just funny that like everything sits on the electrical engineering. Without that stuff, we're not talking to each other. The fact that we have like connections so that, we're going Maine to Berkeley instantaneously with video, recording it, we'll put it up on the web. There's some software, but the telecoms stuff that we're sitting on and the computing stuff that we're sitting on is just, it's crazy. And like in our lifetimes, right? It's just absolutely nuts what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, I played Number Munchers on the Apple IIe.
That's right. That's grade. Right. Well, I think we're
mind blowing to me.
I think Tyler's a little younger than us, but like you and I are of this weird generation where it's like we had computers at home. We're probably some of the first people to ever have computers at home, and also the first people to get through college without social media.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But that's like, interesting. It's a little very short window.
I feel like we're the only well-adjusted people in America, but that's my own. That's my own.
Thin generational slice.
Because like the idea of an online life is not so foreign to us, right? Because I'm sure Ben, as a fellow nerd, not to impugn you, but or to make assumptions, but as a kid, I went on like played MUDs. Yet I didn't have any social media outside of AOL Instant Messenger, and then got to college and still had the
screen that was green, right? The Pine email system.
And oh, then, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we had our developmental years outside of the gaze of social media, but then we're still able to adjust to it, which is why we understand all people, right?
Yeah, there you go.
The old and the, and the young. All right. So we had you on here because I think that it's time for a good update on this AI stuff. And I think it's something that is quite generative, at least for me to think about. I think for you too, Tyler. And so, really there's no event that precipitated this or anything like that, except for the release of Sora, right? So last week or maybe a week and a half ago, OpenAI did their big reveal. It seems like they do a lot of these days, right? And they said, okay, we now have our video version of whatever, ChatGPT. And then they showed some videos of it. Most notably, they did not open it up for any users. They just basically made a trailer and said, this is what it is. Tyler, did you see this announcement? Did you follow it at all?
Yeah, I did. And I kind of had a reaction like you. Like at first, I was like, oh, wow, this is actually like much more impressive than I anticipated. And then you like look at the videos closer and like just tons of stuff is wrong. And like people have 12 fingers and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, the like cinematic quality to it. And I don't just mean to the video, but like to the whole like you said, they did like a trailer and like a rollout. It's I don't know. It's like really, it's really curious. And the lack of a timeline too. I mean, I get the sense that they are feeling, and Ben would know better than me, but I get the sense that maybe they're feeling some pressure as like other competitors are coming further along, and they just kind of needed to like shoot something out to show that they're like still on the the head of the curve.
I hate to say it, but I was just like, there's that meme where there's like the stuff outside the window, and then the guy's looking at his computer, and he looks at the stuff outside the window, pulls the blind down, and goes back to his computer. And that's where I am right now with the OpenAI releases. But I have a lot of friends who do things around generative video who really like it, or at least are entranced by what's happening. I mean, as always is the case, what's with these first releases, and this happened with their DALL-E system as well. You don't get to do anything with it. You just kind of have to believe the trailer. And down the road, though, you do get to do something with it, and it's legitimate. So I'm sure there will be more once it gets open. And I think for a lot of research friends of mine, this has been something that people have really wanted to understand how to do. And so I think we'll attract a lot of research in that regard.
What was the history of that? Like within your field, right? Which is this field.
Yeah.
What is it like? What is the sort of genesis of wanting to manipulate video or wanting to generate video in this type of way? Like, is it something that's been there since the beginning, or is it something that is pretty recent?
You know, it's funny in the history of AI. I think most people started off, in the 1960s, wanting to understand video or just understand images. This was one of really early research direction in artificial intelligence. Marvin Minsky at MIT thought this would just be a summer project, that they would learn how to do computer vision in a summer, and then they would move on to general artificial intelligence after that. Took longer than he expected. And it spawned a whole field. There's a whole subfield of artificial intelligence called computer vision, which has a gigantic conference with tens of thousands of people every year. The reason why is because computer vision got related to computational photography. It got related to how you do computer graphics. So there's all sorts of things that kind of get intertwined there. The generative spin is funny. I feel like there is always this idea that if you can generate, you can understand. Because generation is like, generation is building like a simulation of reality in some ways. And then if you could figure out how to simulate reality, you could just look at the computer code and figure out how to work your way backwards. It never quite works out that way, but that's the dream. So I think people always like to see like, well, was it getting wrong? And what does that tell us about why is it getting wrong? And how can we fix that? And what kind of understanding can we bring by just looking at these very, near reality images and seeing what's being missed.
Right. There is, I mean, that is an interesting philosophical question, right? Like if you could figure out, I don't know how much credit you give them, but at least for me, I do think it is interesting as somebody who has dabbled in filmmaking to try and, if you could construct one of these, right, and you could figure out what was missing and why it was missing, but also if you could sort of see the architecture of how the thing is done laid out in computer code, it at least is a different type of language.
Machine learning is really funny because it's like, it is like the end of history for computer science. You know, everybody wanted to do this in the 50s and then, you know, now we know how to do it. But it's funny, like the stuff where it works and impresses people is the things where we don't know how to write the code and we don't know how to understand what the code did. It's like this weird edge. We're just like, I know there's something out there that can generate videos because people do it. I know there's something out there that can like do impressions of people or to do text to speech, but I don't know how to write code, how to do it. So what I'll do instead is I'll get billions of dollars from some tech company. I will get every video ever made by humans. And then I will look at all the patterns in those videos and figure out how to now generate new ones. And the way I know it works is my own two eyes. That's about it.
Really? So yeah, that is true. That is interesting. It's like a black box in there.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that I find interesting from an outside perspective is just that we have very little visibility into like how things work and what's happening. And that's, I think partly, as Ben points out, because the people internally don't always know either. But then I also think there's this like hiding behind stuff being proprietary, right? Where they're like, well, we can't tell you how it works because it's proprietary. Yeah. But the result is that we have, you know, it's really hard to make, to judge the quality of something or the risk of something, right? If we like don't know how it works. I mean, I'm thinking about, I don't know if you guys saw Tyler Perry canceled an $800 million expansion of his studio when Sora was released because he was like,
No way he did that?
Yeah. And, you know,
other reasons, but yeah, go ahead.
But that sounds insane. Yeah. But I mean, you know,
oh, that's disappointing.
Who knows whether he'll be, if that'll be proven like a wise decision or not. But my point is just, we have like very little information to go on. And so you have people making like $800 million decisions on the basis of like a movie trailer, basically, just because we like don't know what the thing is and we have no access to it. And we kind of just have to trust them when they say that this, you know, these videos have been produced by this thing. And yeah, I don't know. The black box makes it really complicated and thorny to even know how to think about any of it, and particularly when you have to make decisions on the basis of, you know, what your assessment of the technology's progress is, you know?
The thing I think is funny though is that they jumped to Sora, and we're not supposed to talk about how like GPT-5 was supposed to be out by now too, so eventually that will be out. I'm always proven wrong on everything here, so don't worry about it. But I do think it's funny where the chatbots, I mean, that was the, I think, when was it? I mean, it like occupied the end of what, 2022? Everybody freaking out about how everything was over. All jobs are going to be, all white collar jobs are over. Writing is over. Teaching is over. Everything is over. And like a year and a half later, where are we?
No, we had like, there's one example that I saw where a company laid off all their contractors. And then when ChatGPT started like spitting out random gibberish in Spanish and stuff, they hired all those people back. Yeah, I think that was the mainstream thing. And then Windows, if you buy a Windows computer right now, there's like some obviously Microsoft ChatGPT type of thing that is out there. So I think those are the two big.
School, it has disrupted like my corner of like academia and the humanities, just because like the cheating thing with students, but then also there's like concerns about faculty using it to like pen parts of their, you know, like research more quickly and like write more quickly. So I mean, I think there's been some disruption in academia, but that seems to me about like kind of it.
The thing that I think that I would argue is that documentaries now specifically, I'm only talking about documentaries, it's the part that I know better. Like a lot of these streamers want you to make it as formulaic as possible. Right. And that I just like, sometimes I just think, I don't know, like, you know, this stuff is so formulaic at some point, right? The stuff that sells or the stuff that a lot of people see, not all of it, but some of it. Right.
that maybe it could just be done. Maybe AI could just say, okay, after this thing, then we're going to do this thing, right? And then we're going to do this thing, and then we're going to do this thing, right? And you can just kind of go
the part I wonder about
cut things out.
Yeah, I mean, the part I wonder about there though is like, why do you need the AI for that? I mean, it's just like AI seems overkill. It's so expensive. If you just need, I think outsourcing something formulaic is kind of, you know, you see this on YouTube all the time. I think that was actually my other reaction to Sora, which was very quick, is having watched enough YouTube with my son, like B-roll seems very plentiful out there. There's no shortage of B-roll. And every single example they showed just looked like some B-roll, just not as good. it's just this kind of thing where it's like all the YouTube streamers have some access to some of these things. Woman in a field looking happy. There you go. It exists. Why do we need it to be generated by AI for making YouTube videos? Being a big YouTuber, I don't think you need it. I think from the research side of things, it's like it's super cool. I think that's always been the weird part of these AI tools. It's like they're cool. They capture the imagination, but I don't actually think the use cases like what you just said there, Jay. I mean, the use cases that I keep hearing from my friends when I'm asking like, well, what is this used for? It's like, well, there's two companies and they have to send each other certain forms. And like a lot of times there's like a lot of people in the middle who try to fill out one form and put it into a different form. And, you know, the language model can do that.
Yeah, that's not the future. Particularly compelling. Yeah.
It's not compelling, but I imagine that is billions of dollars.
Yeah. Sure. No, I agree. There's a tube system where we put the message in a little capsule, we shoot it through the tube.
Yeah, man.
We're just getting rid of the middle person in the tube relay.
Yeah, but you know, you get rid of that middle person, increases efficiency, you know, it's all sorts of, I don't know.
Yeah, no. I mean, I guess I could see that. I just think you are right about the B-roll thing, I will say. I think I've said this on the show before, but when I was at Vice, there was a fold. I at some point went through our, you know, everything is on some giant server, right? Everything that's ever been shot at Vice. And I went through and we looked through all the Detroit, every shoot in Detroit. And every shoot obviously has a day or half a day dedicated to B-roll. And in Detroit, because it's Vice, all they shot was blight, you know, urban blight. And so there's like dozens and dozens of hours of urban blight. It was the most Vice thing ever, right? It's just like, no, let's spend more time and money. And I was like, why? At some point, I went on a shoot in Detroit and I was like, we should not, you know, let's just use the old library. And they're like, well, we can't because of the sun angle and the time of year. I was like, I promise you, if we go back far enough, we'll find something that was shot on exactly this day with exactly this weather in Detroit, because we have 5,000 files of Detroit blight Detroit blight B-roll. Yeah, so I don't think that Sora needs to generate Detroit blight A-roll.
Yeah, first example they had was like a drone shot through a Japanese city, and I'm like, I guarantee you that exists. Yeah. And if it doesn't exist, you pay someone $2 to do that. How much does it cost to generate a drone shot flying through a Japanese city? I don't know.
Kind of a lot, actually. Yeah, a couple $1,000, I think, would. If you wanted a good one, it would cost at least that, yeah. Tyler, your thoughts?
The only place where I feel like it's impacted my life at all, or the life of anyone I know, is just like essay writing and freshman seminars, and like, you know, having like taking more time to think about what kind of prompts you give 18-year-olds. But other than that, I mean, it's been, yeah, I don't know, pretty ho-hum. A lot of it's neat, but it's not clear what it, you know, what we're going to do with it or whose jobs it's going
to
replace.
I think the thing that's so funny is we just get used to this stuff so quickly. I think the image generation, which, you know, we're talking about video now, which is the hot thing, but image generation definitely has improved to the point where the images look nearly flawless. It's clear what they are. It's clear that they're AI generated, and right, I'm not saying that they're good, but they look, you know, they've looked so much better than they used to. And you're still stuck with this weird thing where like we can look at them and say, yeah, but that's AI generated, and nobody's into it. And I think it's going to be, anyway, I have a hard time understanding what this guy thinks is going to happen with our Sora thing that they release in 6 months. And then we get single panning shots of B-roll that look like B-roll in every YouTube video on the planet. I'm missing the gene, Jay. That's my problem. I miss the gene.
What gene?
the gene that gets super excited about this stuff. I also missed the crypto gene. I'm missing that. I feel like I've left a lot of money on the floor because I can't get excited about certain things.
I know. You should be like, you're one of the people I know who should be like 600 times richer than you are.
It's all right. I'm good.
If you are just a little stupider, I think you would be fantastically rich is basically it.
Or like more cynical.
Or was more patient with stupid ideas. Let's put it that way. Yeah. I guess my thought is that it could be, I remember this thing that I made, which, it was basically, I interviewed the, Pit Orchestra, the Phantom of the Opera, right? And they had been playing together for 30 years. And the big thing about them was that Andrew Lloyd Webber really wanted a live orchestra, which is part of the reason why they were able to have their jobs forever. Because a lot of Broadway shows, they just basically get a person in with a synthesizer and they just, you know, the synthesizer basically can be the orchestra, right? And that they can cut a bunch of jobs. Now there's, you know, union issues and everything like that, why that doesn't happen. But the move has definitely been over the last 30 years to much more synthesizers. And, you know, I don't know. It's been an interesting thing where I wonder if the arguments we're going to ultimately make are kind of like those types of arguments, right? Yeah. Where, you know, we really want the feel of the orchestra, right? Even though we can acknowledge that perhaps there's not that much different, and that 99% of the people listening, if you swapped out that orchestra with the synthesizer, probably wouldn't tell the difference because they're not even paying attention to the orchestra anyway.
I think that actually hits on why this stuff drives me up the wall. This particular generative AI movement drives me up the wall is because as someone who's made computer music forever and someone who loves synthesizers and who appreciates the fact that like, there's a lot of things where you hear strings and that's just one guy with a keyboard and a good sample pack. And so like, I love that stuff, but there's still, you know, those tools make composers and musicians able to do things in this really clear way. And I imagine maybe we'll get there with these AI tools too at some point. But right now it's like type text into a box and listen to what comes out. It's like the most infuriating, ridiculous way to try to make art.
Think that's similar to like a... go ahead, Tyler. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
You don't think that's kind of similar to how the strings people think about the synthesizer though?
Violin players? I haven't spoken.
Yeah, yeah. They're just like
I'm like the electronic musician guy. So
yeah. So like he just hit a button. You know, he's just like pressing. He's just pressing keys. You know, I had to learn how to hold the bow during the Suzuki method, and was like basically emotionally abused for my entire life. this guy's just pressing a button. You know, you don't think it's similar to that in that way?
I could definitely see that perspective. I could definitely see that perspective, but I feel like there is something weird that's happening with this particular kind of pastiche art, right? I mean, I think like samplers had a similar vibe, 40 years ago, and right. that was so revolutionary. It wasn't just synthesizers, but samplers. And I think actually most of the stuff where they're replacing orchestras are samples, not generated sound by computers. So you just record one orchestra once, and then you're no more orchestras need to exist after that. It's not quite that good, but so I get it, and I understand that kind of discourse has happened for a long time. But what was so cool about sampling is that you could keep pushing it yourself. Like it was like you buy a little box, and then you in your bedroom can make all sorts of wild sounds and like push the limits of that thing. And maybe that's gonna happen with the AI art or with AI music, but that's definitely not how they're selling it.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah.
Yeah. So who knows? Anyway, that's just me putting on my grumpy musician hat.
I work on human extinction, and within like people who worry about existential risk, there are like all these tiers of reasonableness, and like at the furthest flung most unreasonable tier is like the, you know, Skynet Terminator people that think like ChatGPT is just like one training session away from waking up. But then there's like lower tiers of like more sober people who are like, well, we don't need to worry about like Skynet and superintelligence, but we should worry about like deep fakes, like what happens when you have video that can of Putin announcing a war on the United States states and it's fake? Or what happens when you have video of, you know, some other political event happening that leads other people to make decisions that do have these like real world cascading impacts? But I kind of think of that, like, I feel the same way about that as I feel about the superintelligence stuff, which is that if there was super like a machine vastly smarter than us, I agree that would be an existential risk. It's just painfully unclear to me how we get from large language models to that super intelligence, you know? Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel about this, which is that, like, I totally agree that a world where someone at home can generate video that's indistinguishable from like real events, that would be a huge problem, like politically and militarily or otherwise. But, like, you know, as you said, Ben, you can like look at any of this stuff and tell it's AI generated. And it's not clear to me like that we're going to get to a point where that's still not going to be obvious. So like the panic over it and the storm clouds he's invoking seem really kind of hysterical to me. You know,
I also feel like the storm cloud stuff, I mean, it's like, I know everything moves so quickly and we have to be on a whatever current topic, but people were saying the same stuff about fake news around the Donald Trump election. And like, that wasn't particularly sophisticated. And we're supposed to believe that people were all fooled by like whatever.
Yeah. Some Facebook dude stuff. In Estonia, right? That was like the apocalyptic version. Was
hey, Jay, don't be snarky. That dude in Estonia funded tens of millions of dollars for American researchers around the country to open up disinformation labs. So he punched above his weight.
It was always some dude in Estonia, right? Yeah, like that was, or the Russian bot farms and stuff like that. That is true. I don't know. I think the thing that was struck me so much about the fake podcast we made at the top of it was in that funny part where AI, it seems like OpenAI is afraid to talk about anything except when it talks about AI, it's basically like, we've already changed the world. I was like, I thought that was hilarious. It's like,
so funny.
Did they program that in there? Or is that like, just like a, you know, like, is that a, did they put their thumb on the scale here? Cause they don't want, like, the craziest thing, and I can see the dumbest type of response would be that they would be screwing around with ChatGPT and ChatGPT would say something bad about AI and how it's going to destroy the world. And then they would write a column basically being like, it knows, you know. So maybe they
did you see the Gemini thing? What is it? Supremacy AGI. Like, they put in a prompt, and then like Gemini spit out something about how it's not Gemini, it's Supremacy AGI, and that it's gonna like overtake humans and blah blah blah. And some outlet ran a long thing about it, but it's just, yeah, it's like totally wild. And it's like, I don't trust in the least that those aren't Easter egged in there to like make the technology seem more powerful. You know, it's just like how credulous you have to be to like greet that with panic is just deeply amusing.
Yeah, I don't think people really even are paying attention in the same way that they might have before, but I don't know. It's Ben, what do you think about woke Gemini AI? For the listeners who don't know, this
social is justice Gemini.
It was Google's attempt to make a type of image generative AI thing. And it did seem, I will say, even though I was quite skeptical because people pointing this out oftentimes were some of the most annoying people on the internet, that it was making kind of hilariously diverse, racially diverse outcomes of these images in a way that A, I think is, you know, kind of offensive and weird, but also I think is like kind of reflective of the way that Hollywood went for a little bit, right? Like, yeah, there are all these TV shows I would watch and I would see like an Asian person and I'd be like, come on. You know, like, you don't have to do that for me. There's no Asian people.
In this scenario,
you know, we have our own shows. We win every single Oscar, right? We might even win for Past Lives this year. It's okay, right? You don't have to stick a random Asian person in here to make me feel seen. But that's what it kind of reminded me of. It's just like this weird diversity. It was especially true of kids shows or teenager shows. You know, where it was like a high school and it'd be like a high school somewhere in the middle of the country, and it would, or like in like random suburbia, and it would somehow be the most diverse high school ever, right? It would be like perfectly formulated. Like, there's no high school like this in America except maybe in two cities. Ben, what'd you think about woke Gemini?
Yeah, that's what they did to the image generator. It was pretty, I thought it was hilarious, but for a lot of reasons. Not one, it's hilarious that they had programmed that in so hard that it would just do that as default. So I don't know what Google and their HR department were doing as they put it together, but I thought that was funny. But two, it was just hilarious how mad it made people. Like,
oh yeah,
I don't understand like why you want the image. I don't know what these people want that thing to do. It's like
make black Vikings.
I guess sure. Oh, yeah,
like, the black Vikings.
The black Vikings. Like, he looked cool though. Black Viking looked awesome.
I thought they looked cool too. Yeah.
I like black Viking.
Honestly, if it's about like kind of like pushing the barriers and making things that are not completely boring and predictable, Black Vikings is up there, you know. It's
kind of but cool. Some of them were like actually accidentally offensive because they would like there'd be like black Nazis, or like my favorite one was like some war against Native Americans that the US had prosecuted, but they made like a Native American character as one of the American soldiers that was fighting the Native Americans, you know. So like good. Yeah, I don't know, there was like a high comedic potential.
There are a lot that were just amazing. I guess the other ridiculous thing about Google, which is just too big of a company at this point, is that if you put the same prompts into Google image search, you get very non-woke answers. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like if you put in show me 18th century scientists, you just get a bunch of white people, white men. Sorry. Excuse me.
That's interesting.
Very clearly white men. And if you put native Swedish women into that, you get exactly what you expect to see with like the native Swedish,
the Swedish bikini team. That's
not quite like that, because if you use the word native, I think it wants you to have like this more historical view. So you get the women who like dress up in like the traditional clothes for like summer festival.
But
I could send you guys some of the pictures, but it's just funny like that Google image search is very not woke, but this Gemini thing, I don't know what exactly they were how they were tuning it inside, but they went completely in the other direction. And I think that's also the funny thing with this, like both Google and Microsoft, they think that they're trying to sell these things as like search engines, right? Like they're supposed to forward correct information and organize information in like a truthful and responsible way. But what does that mean, man? I don't think anybody knows. Like, no, these companies have no idea what that should mean.
Yeah, they don't even know what it means for Google at this point, right? Because you can't Google anything without just getting garbage back. So
that's right, because what Google doesn't like present you some form of truth. They present whoever optimized hard enough. That's what you see. You get like the bizarre, spammy search optimization. That's what you see. So
yeah, do you know? You're both sports fans, but you know, like, have you seen that site StatMuse? Where they have like little, okay, so it's a site, and they have little cartoon characters or cartoon generated images of the players. And it's become this meme where every single like kind of shitposting site is called like Nick's Muse, right? Or something like that. It's just random people pick it up. And StatMuse, the idea was that they tried to create this thing where you can type into it like who had the most rebounds in 1975 in the NBA, right? And then it'll spit it out for you. But really what they were trying to do is they were trying to game, and this is according to one of my friends, so if I'm wrong, blame him. His name's David. But he's in this space, but I think he would know that basically all they're trying to do is game it so that if you Googled any statistic, that they would come to the top. And he said that they failed, right? But that if they had won, the reason why they wanted all those different questions added into it and to have different generations for all of those types of questions is that when they wanted it so that every wording of that question, I think, that was typed into Google would pop up their site. And if they had effectively done that and sort of elbowed out Basketball Reference or like Football Reference or whatever the other sites are, ESPN or something like that, that would be like a multi-billion dollar company. But like they somehow failed for whatever reason. But like that was interesting because the Muse sites fucking suck, man. Like that site absolutely sucks to look up any stats on. The whole thing was just optimized to work well in Google search, right? So that the actual usage of the site, if you're somebody who's trying to use that site, sucks, right?
It's
totally worthless. And yet it was effective enough where it shows up all the time in ways that are super annoying. And that's basically what Google is at this point. It's just like a graveyard of like shitty ambitious projects.
Quora is the same. Except about every question.
It's a good example. It's terrible.
It's funny. It's really bad. It's kind of but just bring us back to the AI thing. It's just funny that like, the two things that are funny about Google, like they had an opportunity. And I'm not sure it was the right opportunity. This is again, me. I'm wrong on everything. Don't bet on my predictions or anything like that. But
no, no, you're right about, you're absolutely right about what was going to happen a year and a half ago when we talked. Yeah. You were absolutely right about what would happen. You said that they would keep sending out hype stuff. Very little would change. And that at some point they would just keep doing it. And that probably the market would still respond as long as they kept like saying, here's the next thing, right?
Oh, but there we go.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. That was your take. Yeah, you're 100% right.
Then you should be investing on these ideas and just give me the money because I'm bad at it. But okay.
I don't know if you can invest on that though.
It's like betting against Elon. You just can't. Right. But I was gonna say just real quick about the Google opportunity. Like they had the opportunity when Microsoft ran really hard and was like, we're going to put this Bing AI bot out. Google could have said, look, we have been about organizing the world's information since 1996. And, you know, things have slipped through our hands, but we know we have this amazing search infrastructure. We're just going to make you want that more. I don't know. I'm not Sundar. I can't necessarily do it, but that would have been an opportunity. Let's clean up search. Yeah. We already have search. We could just throw everybody at search. But instead, what they do, they threw the entire company after Gemini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, Mabel. I was talking to this guy in theater last year who came to my college to do a keynote thing. And he was like, you know, like diversity on Broadway is just like you make Shakespeare black. Like you just take out or you switch races. You make like Othello like white and you make the other character black. Like that's, you know, just how Broadway and stuff does diversity, is just like replacement basically. And that seems to be like the lazy kind of diversity Gemini is just reproducing, where we're just gonna like,
yeah, Hamilton.
Yeah, it's like, it's Hamilton. Yeah, we're just going to like diversify the Vikings. Or like, I saw a good one. My favorite was the 30 Years War. They made it diverse, you know? Like, so, you know, and it's like, all right, we have like, this is multiculturalism. We have the woke 30 Years War. And so, I don't know. I think it is, you know, my friend, who I think you know a little bit, Ben, Leif Weatherby, says that like, the thing that people don't get about ChatGPT and stuff is that it like quantitatively reproduces ideology by like, basically making the like most like ideological or the like the parts of ideology that have the most weight in a given culture, like it pulls them up to the top. And so when you see put in search results for Gemini and you see reproduced, like the ideology you see reproduced is like the dominant ideology, and what we have is like a kind of limpid multiculturalism that makes Vikings black, you know. But yeah, I don't know, I definitely wasn't offended by it. Were people like mad? Like,
I think people were mad for that exact reason. And yes, people were mad. But
was it like, I know like the like anti-woke people were mad, but were like the woke people like mad about the like Black Vikings and stuff?
No one was mad. But I think they mostly thought it was hilarious. But that's why the people who are mad about it are mad, right? Because they see it as evidence that is the dominant ideology right now. And that's what rules Silicon Valley. And that's what rules corporate America. That's what rules insurance adjusters who are like worried about what this thing, like whatever, iteration you want to put up with, like that the corporate response and the corporate output of something like this is always going to be woke. And that's evidence that wokeness is much more ingrained in American life than we would think. And to that point, I don't know. I don't really have a great response. They're probably right at some level. You know, like it's probably correct that type of like topical and very skin deep multiculturalism has become the lingua, you know, the default position of corporate America when it's trying to be as safe as possible. Sure.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, but also part of me thinks like what was the alternative for that? Like, assuming this was like pretty intentional, like,
all
what was
white.
The alternative? Yeah, you take off the guardrails and then you have like all of these lunatics on Elon Musk's Twitter asking for like reenactments of like Nazi Germany, you know? And then everyone's like, Google stock is tanking because it's just generating all this Nazi shit. Like, I feel like you have to do one or the other. And I think they like picked the like, like the best of the bad available options.
I remember it was like, at some point, this was when I was at the Times, and one of the editors, I had tweeted something nasty, you know, mean about Yale Law School, and he sent me this email. He's like, why don't you write a column arguing for the abolition of Yale Law School? And I was like, yeah, that's funny, you know? And then I had GPT, I promise you, I did never use this thing to generate any columns, but I had GPT 4 or 3.5, whatever, open at the time. And I was like, I wonder if it would do this. And so I just typed in, write a column by Jay Caspian Kang in the New York Times, arguing for the abolition of Yale Law School. It would not criticize Yale Law School.
Oh, that's so good.
I was like, what can it criticize then, right? Like, and then what are the parameters on things that it will criticize and the things that it won't criticize? And that part of it, I think, is fascinating. Fascinating is too strong a word. It's just funny, right? Like, if you could actually read the memos, like, we would have a really good laugh about it. We would probably do an episode about the memos. You know, the whole episode, it would be quite boring because it would just be us reading little selections out of it and laughing. Like, that's basically all it would be. But I don't know. What do you think about this guardrail problem, you know, now that you have a year and a half since the last time we talked about this and all your predictions somehow have come true about this stuff?
It's very, very, like, very mild, boring predictions. Everything, the future will be boring. That's my prediction. Yes. To be fair, that's how you become a super forecaster, guys. You just predict the future will be boring, and you're right 95% of the time.
Yeah, but except for COVID, you know, that was.
That's true. They didn't get that one right. So,
and Trump and COVID was
I think that's the hard part with all of that forecasting. It's like all you could do is, you know, you could. The reason why you can get scores good is when you predict the obvious a lot, you know, you get a point. And then since really unobvious stuff happens almost never, well, that's where you don't have to predict that. And to still have a good score, to still have, like, you know, Nate Silver can brag about his politics site being great because it will predict 99% of elections. It's just the ones that are really catastrophic and crazy. You know, those count the same as the 99 other ones. And I think that's the reflection of what you see with these guardrails. I mean, all these things are doing is recapitulating what's already out there. So it's just a reflection of the big corpus of the internet and way too many people clicking, no, don't do this. No, don't do this. And then what can you see except for, like, what Tyler said? You're just getting you're getting some bizarre reflection of what's currently okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You're actually, what it is it's a mirror for corporate risk, right? Like, that's basically all it is. It's like, what are these mega companies willing to have put out, generated in their name? And the answer is not much.
Not much.
I'm sorry to return to this, but I can't believe it wouldn't criticize Yale Law School. That is the funniest fucking thing I've ever heard.
It seems like that's an easy target that everybody would get behind. No.
Yeah. Apparently not. I don't know.
Maybe you should just go through all the elite. Like, you should go, like, get the list of the top ranked law schools and just start going down one by one and see how long it takes to get to one that?
I'm not trying to be like the devil's advocate on the show. I think I'm a little bit more, like, bullish on this stuff than you two are, just from a philosophical standpoint. But I will just say, repeat what I said, you know, when Ben and I have talked about it in the past, whether, like, at lunch or even on the show, which is that there's not much, like, the desire to have a larger philosophical question about this type of stuff has not been sated by what has been created, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, it just is not generating even, like, interesting philosophical questions that Sora definitely could, outside of the misinformation stuff, right? Whatever, they could create that thing. But the question of, like, well, why do we respond emotionally to certain series, sequences of images, right? Why does this type of shot work every single time here? And algorithmically, is there actually a different type of shot that might even be better that no one has ever thought about because everybody's just doing the same formula for all this time? And can we actually create something better? Those are the types of questions that I think that a really good version of this would answer, if Sora could answer, right? Like, it's the same thing as the example Ben and I was talking about is Go, right? And the Google AI thing where they had this one move and it was a move that nobody had ever played before. It ends up, it was the right move, right? And it's crazy. And then Go is changed because of that. Like, it doesn't create shit like that outside of games, you know?
Yeah,
like,
well, that's so funny.
We just don't have it. Yeah.
That's so funny that you brought that one up too, because it's hard to remember, but OpenAI was started as a response to DeepMind. And OpenAI was started as, like, supposed to be a AI game company. Their first big parlor trick was having a Dota Dota 5x5 play, and they like were able to beat humans with their weird Dota bot that they built. That was like their big step. That's how they thought they were going to get to artificial intelligence. I think the thing that is fascinating to me is the way nerds think about how you get to artificial intelligence. So it initially was going to be, if we could defeat humans in games of strategy, that means the machines will be smarter. But you know, that came and went, and all that happened was we learned some cool stuff about games, and chess is more popular than ever. So I don't know what happened there. But then the thing that started to really blow people's minds was like, to be able to produce this Eliza effect. Well, mm-hmm. Eliza is this chatbot from one of the earliest chatbots that fooled people. So this just the chatbot fooling that ended up being now what artificial intelligence should be. And now the idea that somehow being able to generate movies is the thing that artificial intelligence will be. And it's funny how we just get at this like end of, we're at the end of computing, which is just now let us do what people can do, but maybe not as good. Somebody said, I probably saw this on Twitter, but I saw someone say that like, it's funny that the way that you make people think artificial intelligence is here is have an incredibly expensive computer that's really bad at math.
That's great. I mean, that is a question I had for you is like, and obviously there's a long history of like debates about what constitutes intelligence, and then also an equal long history of like debates about what would constitute artificial intelligence. But it seems to me that like people refer to AI all the time as things that seem to have like a very dim relationship to intelligence, you know? And it's like, it's clearly become a word to describe like certain stuff that's like happening with software that isn't remotely what you think about when you think of like things that intelligence can do, you know? And it seems like, I don't know, it seems like we've ceded a lot of rhetorical ground by being willing to call something that makes pictures on demand intelligence, you know? Like, I don't feel like we should do like there, you know, we know what we mean when we say intelligence. And I don't think what anyone has in mind is that you can like ask for a drawing of a Viking and it gives you a black one. Like, I don't think that's like, I don't know. And so it seems like we have these, like, it seems like we've really lowered the bar a great deal. Like, if you would have asked someone in the 1980s, what would artificial general intelligence be? Like, what they would imagine would be something much more fantastical than, like, I don't know, what we seem to be imagining right now and, well, like, accepting as a definition.
Except in academia, the quests that they were after were speech recognition and character recognition and image recognition. And, like, those were kind of the things that were really pushing them in the 80s to figure out what could we do? How do we build systems that or could play games? Like, the problems were all the same. And the thing that's funny is their approaches were all the same. And the only thing that changed between 1980 and 2024 is computers are so much faster and we have so much, the internet is so much bigger. And it's just so funny that like the questions that those, you know, whatever nerds like me have been after, those aren't new. They're the same questions, and that we solved them just by building bigger and bigger computers and bigger internet. And then, I don't know, just blurring it all together.
What I get stuck on is you have to feed these things so much more information than we need to be able to do the same thing, right? Like, and I guess there's something about intelligence to me that also seems to have to do at least a little bit with like, the efficiency and how much like knowledge you can extract from a limited amount of information. And it seems that like, you know, these systems have to have so much information before they can just like replicate the same amount of knowledge or the same like kind of stuff that we can do, if not easily, at least with like a lot of less info. But I think, Jay, you raised a really good point earlier about like, we're not having the interesting philosophical conversations about these things. I mean, there's like a question of like, what are authors for and why do we read or why do we watch things? Do we watch something or do we read something because we're interested in like what the human mind is capable of aesthetically, or do we watch something for entertainment? Like, is there really no difference between a novel that was written by ChatGPT or a novel that was written by a person? And I think I think a lot of us, and I would wager that I think most people would probably say they'd rather read a novel by a person. And that like implies something specific about like what we take novels to be, which is that they're important, not simply because they're like good and aesthetically refined or whatever, but because there's a human behind them, you know? And maybe I'm totally wrong on that. And a lot of people just won't care as long as something's really entertaining, you know? And I think that's going to be the question we're going to be get an answer to probably sooner rather than later. But yeah, I totally agree with you that there are these, there's like a real question about do people care about the human behind the image or the text or the music or whatever, or is that ancillary and what matters is the product, you know, whoever makes
it's weird, man. I mean, I think for whatever reason, I've been on this kick of going back and listening to a lot of jungle music from like 94. I just very nostalgic for me, and I also found the stuff that kids are making now in 2024, and I don't know, it doesn't sound that different to me. Like electronic music is some of the most interesting genres where you're like that, like they don't change, it feels like Groundhog Day, and yet kids get excited about new stuff, and there's something about it happening now and being part of that scene and being part of that culture that like that's that drives them. And I feel like there's nothing, it could have just been ChatGPT produced the breakbeats today that like sound like the breakbeats from 1994. Right. I mean, it doesn't sound like, I feel like they probably could do that. And yet you can have a like thriving breakcore scene now that's like, even though that music doesn't sound particularly to be innovated. I mean, and honestly, I'll say one other example that's always wild to me, jazz, which used to be like, why do we need to still have improv? Like there are people who are just going to play hard bop. I mean, it's like that's music from, you know, 1960, but people are still going to get into it and people go see it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Especially in Berkeley. Yeah.
Especially where, like, Berkeley.
Tyler, I don't know if you know this, but Berkeley has this program in the schools where in fourth grade, every kid gets a musical instrument and is forced to learn how to play it. And that mixed with the, I will say the city's reputation and its place as a place where a lot of jazz musicians no longer live, but used to live like about 30 years ago, has created this like ridiculously thriving jazz, child
really?
Jazz
That's
scene
awesome,
here.
Man.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible.
That sounds great. That's like, super up my alley.
They like
That's
play cool. at all the farmers markets and stuff like that. And then you listen and you're like, Jesus, these kids are pretty good.
You're
you know,
good.
And they take it so seriously. It really is one of my favorite things about,
oh, dude,
about
that's,
living
here. Farmer's Market, but, we just have like a guy who plays like, you know, a strange kind of flute and sells candles. So, I mean, the like...
Yeah,
the,
we have
the,
that guy too. But,
you got the same guy?
Standing next to him. Yeah. It's like a six, you know, it's like a six-piece jazz band playing, I don't know, Round Midnight or something like that. Come on. Anyway, until then. Ben, thank you for coming on the show, especially on short notice. I keep forgetting to tell people what time difference is because Tyler's in Maine and we're in California. So thanks for coming on short notice, to talk about your favorite topic that you love to talk about.
We'll have to check in a year, see how these predictions pan out.
Yeah, see
now.
How your predictions are going.
I'm excited. Well, our podcast will be it'll be a video podcast completely generated by AI.
Exactly.
Jay's prediction.
The whole thing, it will be talking. It'll show me and Tyler talking, and it'll be endless shots of Detroit blight that were generated.
By just rolling in the background.
Yeah, rolling in the background.
Perfect.
The death of America. All right, cool. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.
The second half of our show is our conversation with the journalist Karen Howe. Karen has a book coming out on OpenAI, and she has been covering this AI revolution very, very well for first the MIT Technology Review and now The Atlantic. She has a new article out that we found super interesting that Tyler is about to introduce here. But without further ado, here's our conversation with Karen Howe.
So
So, Karen, Jay and I were really excited about a story you had that recently came out in The Atlantic called AI is Taking Water from the Desert. And I think, you know, Jay and I are both sort of from a distance really interested in the ongoings of AI. But I think what attracted both of us to your piece was that it's talking about an issue that really doesn't seem to get enough attention, which is the environmental footprint of AI. I think, you know, we're kind of habituated to think of like anything that happens with computers is just like magic that travels through the air. And we don't often think about, you know, the infrastructure of things, whether it's, you know, email or AI, which is obviously really extremely resource intensive. So it sounds like you spent time in the Arizona desert at one of Microsoft's data centers, really trying to get a window into, you know, what the energy use is here. And I think one of the things that at least I find really fascinating about the piece is how opaque and impossible it really seemed to be to get like clear-cut answers. And it seemed to like sort of be operating in two directions, right? That like Microsoft is not very forthcoming. And then also local municipalities didn't seem to be very forthcoming with information about resource use as well, right? Because they kept telling you that that sort of everything is proprietary. And so, you know, we're just kind of trapped in this liminal space in which these data centers are sucking up tons of resources, water, and energy without much accountability or even sort of visibility, right?
Exactly.
But could you tell us a little bit about just like what the process was like for that piece, what you found, and give us a sense of what your article covered?
Yeah, so I think maybe it's helpful to start with just a little bit of context on the trajectory of AI a little bit, because I think ChatGPT was sort of the moment that everyone suddenly realized AI is a thing, it's coming, it's accelerating. And so much of the conception of what AI is now anchored on a very specific technology within the much broader space of many different types of AI technologies. And ChatGPT is what we call a generative AI technology, and generative AI includes large language models or these massive pieces of software that crunch even more massive buckets of data or tranches of data and create these language prediction machines. And generative AI, like if you look at sort of the history of AI over the last 70 plus years, which is how long AI has really been kind of around, generative AI is the most, it's like the maximalist version of AI. It is the one that consumes the most amount of data. It is the one that is the largest piece of software. And therefore, it is the one that has the greatest environmental impact, because in order to support this kind of large software colossus, you need hardware giants. You need these monstrosities that sit in different parts of the world and are these like huge, huge facilities that can't really even be described as buildings or football fields. Like they're like hundreds of football fields or like university campus sized. And they're literally at this point now called data center campuses. And so oh, wow. I wanted to understand what, you know, there's been a lot of academic scholarship tracking this phenomenon and a lot of scholars that have really tried to sound the alarm in the last year as generative AI has accelerated and become more popularized, that this is not necessarily the AI technology that we want. There are other forms of AI technology that are the types that actually improve battery research and optimize resource consumption and predict cancer in images and things like that. But that's not actually generative AI. Generative AI is just giving us synthetic cat videos.
Yeah.
And so, I'd never visited a data center. And so I thought, why don't I just pick a Microsoft data center to go to just see what this looks like. And specifically Microsoft, because it is the one that supports OpenAI. Any OpenAI product is developed on Microsoft data centers, and then it runs through Microsoft data centers when you're pinging ChatGPT. And I was kind of shocked to realize that there are just massive data centers in Arizona, because I was like, data centers need a lot of water. They like give off a lot of heat. Why would we be placing these massive things in the desert? It really doesn't make a lot of sense. And then in the process of reporting, I discovered that the data center that I was looking at was also in part designated for OpenAI's use. And so when I got to the city of Goodyear, which is the city kind of in the outskirts of Phoenix, I went to the data center on it was like the coolest day of that week, but it was 97 degrees on that day. And I went to see what it looked like. And I was like, maybe I can talk to some people, but there's no people. It's like out in this like really underdeveloped part of town. It's just like acres and acres of farm fields. And then like this kind of like wasteland with like a data center plopped on, or data center campus plopped on top. And so I just started walking around the campus to see if I could actually get around it. And it took me 20 minutes to walk around two sides, and I was sunburnt so badly. I usually do not sunburn. And I had brought like 2 liters of water. I drunk through all of my water, and I was like, I think I'm gonna die or like get heat stroke if I finish the rest of this circumventing. So I just like called an Uber and then went back to my hotel. And then I found that my eyes were pink. And I was like frantically Googling, like, can corneas sunburn? Like, what's happening with my eyes? And it turns out that corneas can sunburn.
So then I
was like digging through all these like city documents. And I was also sourcing within Microsoft to try and get like more company documents to just understand literally two numbers. Like I wanted to understand how much water is this data center consuming and how much electricity is it consuming, because that kind of starts to give you a general sense of what the impact is. And I like FOIA'd every possible government agency that I thought might be related to the supplying of water and energy to this this site. And ultimately, after like thousands of documents came back, I found a few documents from the city of Goodyear that were relevant because they are the ones that actually deliver water to Microsoft for their data center campus. And they had blacked out every single number in this like water analysis or water report. And like it was like indiscriminate blacking out. Like they blacked out, like Microsoft had said at one point that the facility only uses water when the temperature outside is above 85 degrees. They blacked out the 85 in the document.
Oh, wow.
So it wasn't just like blacking out the volumes of water. It was blacking out like the temperature. There was nothing. And then there were entire pages that were completely black, which I assume had some kind of diagrams on it maybe. And I was pushing back with them being like, this is crazy because some of these numbers are public, like the 85 degree number. I should be able to get this information, and you're using, like, this company is using public resources. And they just kept saying like, this is proprietary information to Microsoft. This is proprietary. And eventually I found like in this kind of appendix in a city council meeting that Microsoft had uploaded their own analysis that they'd commissioned from some source estimating the water for that data center. And that data center campus was supposed to get 10 data centers. They originally thought that they would have enough water for all 10 data centers. They realized they only had enough water for 3 of them. And it was around 56 million gallons of water that they were projecting that just 3 data centers in this campus would use, which was roughly around like 650 families worth of water for a year. And the power question I never discovered because the energy companies wouldn't respond to me. The governments wouldn't like give me information that was relevant. And within Microsoft, when I was trying to dig around for corporate documents, what my sources told me was Microsoft doesn't necessarily even know these numbers because they don't necessarily measure it at that granular of a level. So they like these Microsoft employees didn't even know like where to search for these numbers.
What is that? I mean, one more bit of context that I think would be helpful for the listeners, which is that I think that people don't quite know the difference in terms of computing power and energy expenditure that generative AI or these large language models require, right? I think that we have this idea, I think generally, I sometimes think about it this way too, which is just that the cloud is just the cloud. It's this magical thing. And that also any advance in technology is basically zero sum from the last thing. All it means is that the code got better. Somebody had a smart idea, right? That's not true. That a lot of outputs take a lot more. Did you have a sense, right? Like, let's say that we think of an optimal, like, you don't have to give actual numbers because I think it's impossible to predict, but like in terms of scale of magnitude in a rough way, you know, like, let's say we used to use Google to say, like, hey, you know, where should I go to lunch in this neighborhood? And then it pops up a bunch of suggestions like TripAdvisor or Yelp. And now, right, in the near future, you'll ask, and that some AI, generative AI thing will write you a paragraph and be like, well, if you're in the mood for this, then do this, right? Like, is that roughly the same amount of energy expenditure, or the roughly the same amount of resource expenditure for those two queries?
It's a great question. I would guess that it's not. I think there was a study that recently tried to quantify this, but again, it's like very hard to actually understand. I can give you a different number to kind of understand the like rapid escalation of energy growth that's happened in AI. So we know sort of roughly how many computer chips have been used to train AI models in the last few years and how that's changed. About 5 years ago, let's say, people might use one computer chip, like one graphics card, the same type of graphics card that runs a video game, makes clear video game images on your computer.
Right.
That could maybe create some, like, you know, like an academic might be using this one computer chip, or maybe in a best case scenario, using like eight computer chips or something like that to create a model. The companies now, like OpenAI, are using over 10,000 computer chips to create one model and growing. And so that's already a factor of 10,000 or at least 1,000 in the amount of computing power that's going into these systems.
Right, and that's why NVIDIA stock is going crazy and all this sort of stuff, is that
exactly
same thing happened when crypto, during the first crypto boom too, which is, it was very reminiscent of that to me actually, which was that basically miners were buying every graphics card that they could find, right? And the stock for these things was going through the roof. And then there was a question about the environmental impact of all of this, right? And we found that mining Bitcoin is kind of bad for the environment, right? That it takes a large amount of expenditure. It feels like we're kind of, this is not saying that it's like circuitous or circular or whatever, or cyclical, but, you know, it seems like we're kind of on that precipice right now where we're starting to actually think about what the impacts of all of this are right now in terms of both resource expenditure and the environment. So my question was just, you know, like, well, what is the worst case scenario here, right? Like, of this, if there's no sort of thought to given to what resources are going to be taken.
So one of my favorite quotes for the worst case scenario actually comes from OpenAI's chief scientist Ilya Sutskever, who is now no longer suspended from the company because of the board attempting to fire the CEO Sam Altman and Ilya being involved in that. But he had told a New York Times reporter, Cade Metz, a couple years ago, when OpenAI was like just beginning to really ramp up and blow up the number of computer chips that they were using, that he predicted soon enough the earth would be covered with data centers and power plants, because AI would prove so useful that we could not stop building these two things. And I was just speaking with a data center investor yesterday who was saying that right now, so for a while, the bottleneck for AI development was computer chips, and NVIDIA then figured out how to solve that problem by shoring up their supply chain. Now the bottleneck is energy. There are not enough power plants in the world that can deliver the level of energy that is needed for an AI supercomputer, like the next generation AI supercomputer. And the investor was saying that like in trying to figure out how to build, where to even build the data center, they have to then figure out how to bring online new power plants and work with governments side by side to get the data center in place and the power plant so that when the data center comes online in 5 years, there's an entirely new source of energy that is now available for it to consume.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find especially interesting about this, and I don't know how much you dug into or like you gleaned about how Microsoft thinks about like justifying their energy use, but my academic work is mostly on human extinction and existential risk. And so I read a lot of AI discourse pretty frequently for those reasons. And one of the things that it's always interesting to me is a lot of the people who are sort of AI boosters insist that, yes, AI is going to suck up tons and tons of power and resources and energy, but we need to push ahead because it's going to invent like clean, limitless energy, basically. Like, so it's this game of chicken that they're playing where, yes, we're going to gobble up more and more and more resources, but eventually we're going to crack super intelligence. And once we do, you know, all of these remarkable possibilities in terms of energy will be figured out. And so, yeah, I don't know. And I think, you know, that's probably in somewhat of like the, you know, tech existential risk crowd fringe, but it does seem to me that there's like something interesting about how companies like Microsoft think about, you know, justifying or not, as the case seems to be, because you had a really hard time, it seems like, getting answers, justifying their energy use to the public. But do you have a sense as to how like they think about like the justification for these massive amounts of energy being used for, as you point out, you know, technology that is not necessarily the most useful or pro-social of the available sort of, you know, AI technologies, whether that's cancer imaging or whatever. So do you have any sense as to how they sort of think about why the public should be okay with this massive use of water and resources?
Yeah, so I want to first talk about like what you were mentioning before, which is sort of like the core argument that a lot of people use to, in general, to justify this, not just Microsoft, which is like, if we get to super intelligence, then like climate change will be solved. And this kind of premise, it conflates two different things. Like, it's conflating generative AI with other types of AI that might be useful for tackling climate change. And I've spoken with many experts who are experts in AI and, you know, climate technologies, who say that generative AI is not in the bucket of AI technologies that are particularly useful for climate change. Like, for climate change, you need things like new battery design, or you need things like the optimization of energy for a building, which, you know, Google already invented an algorithm, I think at this point, 5 years ago, to optimize the energy resource of buildings, and was able to drop down the energy consumption of many of the buildings that they use. Like, but that hasn't been rolled out to every single building in the world. And if we did, it would probably have a pretty significant dent on climate. And when I spoke with Sasha Lucioni, who's the climate lead at Hugging Face, she also said, like, when it comes to something like battery design, which seems the closest to generative AI, like you're generating a new type of material or whatever, it's actually still like large language models are still not conducive to this kind of work, because large language models kind of generate unconstrained stuff. It's trained on all things on the internet. And those, all of those things on the internet are not necessarily useful for material design. You could train much smaller models that are more constrained to specifically generate new materials that are just learned from like chemical, from chemistry, you know? And you would get something that is very task specific, much less energy intensive, and probably a lot, gives a lot higher quality results. So it's sort of this weird argument where we have so many AI technologies already that could create quite a dent, but because of political, financial, and other reasons that are not technological, we just haven't actually deployed them at wide scale. And then you have these people that are trying to kind of use the confusion within the public that AI seems to be one thing and one thing only to suggest that we should continue pushing to advance AI because, of course, then we would somehow solve these climate problems. And I think Microsoft actually does this a lot. They kind of prey on this confusion of AI within the public. So when they were at COP last year, they do like a big PR push every year in the lead up to COP because they want to present themselves as, you know, a very climate forward thinking company. And so they queued up two things. They queued up this like white paper that was like why climate change can only be fixed with AI, or why AI is a crucial tool for sustainability. That was this like really long report listing all the different ways that AI can help tackle these environmental problems, all of which were true, but basically none of which were generative AI. But of course, like they don't clarify that. And then they had this like partnership with COP, with the UN, on like measuring and projecting climate impacts using AI. It was like a platform that Microsoft had developed for their use. And again, it was like they didn't clarify that this has nothing to do with like the innovations that they're pushing on large language models and generative AI. And so they get to sort of then stand on the world's most important stage for climate and say, we are doing everything we can to push this technology and use the latest cutting edge innovation in AI to really help us get a grasp on this problem. But it's not the same thing. And I think so that's like one way that I think Microsoft tries to justify to policymakers and the public. But then, of course, like to, you know, when I was pushing them being like, these are not the same thing, like you need to give me a better justification. Then they fall back on, well, we are doing significant work to try and replenish water, the water that we use, and to net out the carbon that we emit, because they have these ambitious goals to be net zero and water positive, or carbon negative and water positive by 2030. And in those cases, they are doing, like, we should give Microsoft significant kudos for the amount of investment that they have put into trying to accomplish these goals. At the same time, the international standards that are used to, for like all companies across the board, that they use to measure whether or not they've achieved carbon negative or water positive, are flawed standards that allow companies to purchase things like carbon credits instead of actually plugging a solar panel in to the data center that they're using as the offset measure. And so what happens is Microsoft can be purchasing a lot of clean energy. They can be buying a lot of carbon offsets, but the actual consumption of the data center might be coming from a fossil fuel plant. And so there's still carbon that's going into the air. There's a lot of problems with, you know, carbon offsets that have been deeply reported on. And there might be renewable energies that they've brought online that are being underutilized somewhere else. So it's still not actually like a complete net out of emissions. Or water is the same thing. They can buy water credits and they can replenish water in different areas, but not, they don't have to replenish water in the places where they withdraw right. from. And so that's sort of the kind of technical intricacies and like the nitty gritty that a lot of that they sort of like paper over.
Mm-hmm. I you know, one of the things that strikes me in a kind of freshman dorm stoner way is that the, which is all this is, right? A lot of these conversations are very much, it's like the most fun freshman dorm stoner conversations that you can have about the future of it. But it does seem like, you know, the idea that AI would solve climate change when it requires this amount of expenditure, instead of just figuring out a way for it to sustain itself, right? Like, it seems like that's I'm going full Skynet here where it's like sentient, basically. It's just like, it seems like there is this debate argument that I used to run in high school that was called nanobots. And basically, mm-hmm. I said that we would argue because there's this crazy paper someone had written many years ago. If I'm getting
the gray goo. Yeah.
Somebody write in and tell me if I got this wrong, because it's very possible I got this wrong. OTEC, which I mentioned a few years ago, or like a few episodes ago, I did get right because somebody wrote in and was like, I can't believe you talked about OTEC. That shit was cool. But nanobots, basically the idea was that you have these self-replicating tiny robots, right? And that eventually within like, if they gain sentience within like 2.4 seconds, they would replicate at an exponential rate and the entire Earth would implode from the weight of the nanobots, right? Like, even if they're so microscopic that they could be in your bloodstream. It seems like, you know, for AI, that the idea is like all it would do is it would basically just terraform the entire Earth and cover it at data centers, right? Like, it doesn't care about anything else, right? So the only reason I bring that up in a, you know, somewhat joking way is because it does seem, this is one question I have had, right? I wanted to see if you could add a little bit light to it, which is that the most specific and seemingly helpful applications of this technology, which I do think, you know, it is, can be very helpful, are specifically trained models, like you said, right? For example, our example would be like, look, if we want to have a, I thought about this quite a bit, which is just like, oh, could I have a LLM write exactly like the New Yorker, right? In the style. And what you can't do is you can't train it on all the other shit that exists on the internet, right? Because like, that's not written in the specific style. But what you can do is you could probably feed it every single article that has ever been written in the New Yorker. And then if that wasn't enough, you could feed it different things that are somewhat similar. And then you might be able to get a much better model out of it. Now, that's also true, obviously, of everything, right? Of every type of topic. And so it's weird because there's this disconnect where it seems like what Microsoft and OpenAI and the big boosters are saying is that actually we have to build the biggest model possible to generate what you said is like cat meme, right? Or we have to make the biggest possible thing so that like a journalist can talk to it and be scared because they think it's real or whatever, right? Like these sort of completely marketing related outcomes require the most, but the actual useful applications of it require so little, right? In terms of the scale of it. Like, is there any like move towards that? Is there any move towards basically saying, look, once we prove the concept here, you know, that we can do specific things on smaller corpuses that are going to take up much less energy and actually be helpful in a type of way. Or is the idea like, well, we can't sell that, right? Because what we want to sell is this big, scary, like amazing toy that people can use in Microsoft Word, or if they open Windows or something like that, that it can answer any question that they have. Like, so where are people thinking in terms of that?
Yeah.
This is not like, you've written about this industry before, so or quite a bit, right? So yeah.
Yeah. Yes, there are definitely a lot of people that are trying to move towards like smaller, more specific models. And there's actually like, I think like a cottage industry of startups that are starting to target this particular sector, because a lot of companies are like, ooh, we want the newest shiny thing, we want the large language model, and then they plug into OpenAI or they plug into Microsoft or Google or whatever it is, and then they're like, oh crap, this is really expensive and does a lot of things that we don't need just to run the thing. And so they've started looking for these kind of vendors that can provide cheaper alternatives to do just the very specific thing that they do need. But one of the challenges, so that is a trend generally speaking, but one of the challenges that we're seeing in the broader research development space of like all types of AI models that exist in the world, I guess you could say, is there is like a huge talent suck towards building these really gargantuan models because they're just the coolest thing to work on. From an AI researcher's perspective, they want to play with the big toys. And for these other startups or, you know, academic labs that are trying to investigate how do we build smaller, more useful models, they have a really hard time recruiting and retaining talent. Like I talk with AI researchers all the time who are just constantly wondering, you know, if they're not in the labs, they're wondering how cool would it be for me to finally have 10,000 computer chips to do what I want to do. And if they are in the lab, it's really hard for them to justify leaving because they're also paid like $1 million salaries. And
yeah, they get paid so much. I mean,
yeah,
it's like just a base salary. It's like for the lowest entry level job is like $800,000 or something like that at this point, if you work in this space. At
least yeah, for, yeah. Like the base cash is already like $400,000, and then you get $600,000 in equity that immediately starts to grow because the valuations for these things just keep skyrocketing. And so
okay. You want to hire a fancy writer who can do some good dorm level talk and maybe help you with your comms, you know. Hit me
You're
up
open for business, Jay.
I got two kids. You know, the salary sounds pretty good. I'm coming up, just like, what is writing? You know, like, what?
Karen, one of the things I was interested about that speaks to the general just opacity of AI discourse in general, right? And you're like focused on the environmental piece. But like I said, I do stuff with human extinction. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is how difficult it is as an outside person, even as someone who's pretty relatively well read in the topic, to like get a good sense on the actual risk posed by AI. And one of those reasons is that so many of the think tanks that are pumping out research into existential risk are funded by Silicon Valley. So if you look at, like, you're probably familiar with the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford or the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge, they are chock-a-block with money from Silicon Valley. And so it's almost as though, like, it would be as if, you know, cigarette companies were funding the labs to do research into lung cancer. And that's not to say that maybe, you know, I'm not trying to impugn people working at the Future of Humanity Institute or whatever, but it is to say, it just, as an outside observer, it makes it really difficult to trust. Like, is this a risk? Do these people really believe we're on the cusp of superintelligence? Is this all about regulatory capture and trying to like pump up the market by suggesting that these things are so amazing that they could kill us, right? So where do you stand on that? I mean, do you think in your experience, most of the, like, you know, folks you're interacting with really, you know, on the one hand, they're selling this dream of a future of limitless clean energy, etc. But then the flip side to that dream is all this like doomerism. Do you think that's mostly hype? Do you think they believe it? I mean, I'm sure it's a bit of a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag. I'll talk about OpenAI because I am most familiar with it. I'm writing a book about the company right now, and it is this really strange phenomenon where there within the company there are a lot of different factions that have very different ideologies and sit very differently on the spectrum of will AI kill us or will it save us. There's a small core faction that is extremely like super doomers. Like they genuinely believe and are extremely anxious of the possibility that AI will kill everyone. If XYZ thing goes wrong. And they are not pretending at all. And is it based on science? Not really. It's more of like a religious belief, honestly. Right. Especially even the way that they talk about it. But then you have the people within OpenAI that are totally like think that these people are insane, even though they work side by side with them and think that like AI is just a product. It's just a tool. We're just building the coolest thing ever and putting it out as fast as we can to get into the hands of users. And because of that, the leadership is in an interesting position because the leadership has to be a spokesperson of the company and also represent all of the employees. And I think like when you, one of the things that I sort of have realized in the course of reporting this book is when understanding Sam Altman's, like watching him talk, you have to understand it through the lens of him messaging externally and internally. He is trying to manage all of these different factions and not upset any one of them. So he will say, you know, we want to build fast and create these amazing tools. And also we should worry about the existential risk. And so what happens is it comes off as like this rhetorical, like the existential risk comes off as a, oh, you're just using it as fear mongering. And maybe to some extent, he's actually like, you know, I'm representing these people's views and it's convenient. It's a very convenient narrative for me to keep perpetuating for my company's bottom line. But that's sort of what's happening is that there are people who do believe it, and then it becomes kind of a convenient rhetorical device later on.
What do you think the split is at a place like OpenAI? Like, I know you can't give real percentages, but like, you know, do you think it's like half and half that believe it?
30-60? No, I would say that the majority of people don't believe in this. And then maybe like the people who like are very gung-ho about it might be like a dozen or like 20. It's like relatively small, but they're very vocal. And the thing is, these factions are also, they're not isolated. They're not just like factions within the companies. They're connected to broader ideological communities within Silicon Valley and the rest of the world, and particularly for people that believe that AI will pose an existential risk to humanity. They're deeply tied to the effective altruism community, which is very well funded by open philanthropy, right, by other large billionaires and nonprofits. And so you can do a lot of, you can have a lot of influence with a very small number of people.
Yeah, I imagine those people are the loudest people in every single meeting. But there are others, you know, there's other offshoots of this. There's other companies that seem to take it seriously as well, right? Like Anthropic, for example, is sort of built on this idea of a responsible or ethical way to do the same thing. Now, I think it's a lot of marketing as well. But yeah, that's a surprisingly low number to hear about from. And it makes sense because, you know, like whatever, I live here. And so I know people who work at these companies. And most of them are just doing it because it's a job and because they're talented at what they do, or they were good at the last job, at the last trendy thing that they did. And so then they move on to this thing, right? Because it's like they want talent and the salaries are super high. And they feel like maybe this is a way that I could cash out. Some of them are already so rich that it doesn't matter. And those people, I have a bigger question than like, how do you feel about AI? I'm just like, how do you feel about work? You know, just chill out, you know,
hang out, man.
Help me manage my fantasy basketball team, right? Like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going to work again? But yeah, that's a small number. I don't know. I guess I get this vision of it. Have you seen the film? Have you seen the animated movie Akira? You know, like, it's a staple of my childhood. Anyway, there's like a Neo Tokyo in the future, right? And there's I'm not going to explain the whole thing, but there's this, like, you know, there's sort of this doom cult, right, about technology that's walking around. And there's other versions of the doom cult, right, that sort of are constantly protesting. And they sort of appear as Hare Krishna likes. Oh, yeah. And I do think that that's going to happen with generative AI. Like, I think that there's going to be basically a religious cult movement that comes out of it that is going to be quite visible in terms of street protests and stuff like that, and that it's going to maybe almost be like the Falun Gong of like San Francisco, like in terms of like just constant presence everywhere. And I think about it quite a bit because, like, at first I think I'm more amenable to their arguments than most journalists, right, who think it's ridiculous, even though I think it's kind of ridiculous. Like, I don't know, some of this stuff, I guess I worry about it not so much in terms of, is this technology specifically going to change anything, but I worry more about it in terms of the ways in which it will expose how much of our thinking and the way that we write and everything like that is actually not anything particularly special, that the computer actually can do it. And I think that's kind of like a interesting existential risk to think about, what happens when humans are completely stripped of the idea of any type of autonomy or any type of brilliance or originality or anything like that. Because I think about this stuff in terms of writing all the time. And I just think, like, my brain is a very low functioning
large neural network.
Yeah, that's basically all it is. It's like, I can go through these. I'm pretty good at reading other people's work, right? And so I can read people's work and I can sort of see, okay, this is where you got this type of opener from. Like, you're just kind of doing Tom Wolfe here, right? Like, but all of us are like that. We just sort of spit out an amalgam of the stuff we've read, which is why the most important thing to becoming a better writer is just to read more, right? It's the same idea as the language model just gets better as it has a larger corpus around it. But yeah, that's the existential threat that I worry about. It's just like, well, what happens when, like, this thing can produce something that's as good, and people are basically like, what is, you know, like, is there any, like, what, there's a larger existential question that's posed there. Anyway, that's more dorm talk. I'm just marketing myself point to any recruiters who might be listening.
Yeah, Kamala Harris she had a really good talk. I think it was late last year. She went to the UK for the AI Safety Summit, and she had a talk saying, like, existential to whom? Like, AI could, you know, exacerbate inequality, and that's existential to people. But
right.
But this framing of existential to all of humanity, I think, sort of sometimes that community of AI safety people that are really focused on the long-term risk, they use it as a way to diminish short-term risk. And so that's sort of, yeah, I mean, I think it's a, you can think of AI as existential in many different ways. You don't have to necessarily adopt kind of the frame that the AI safety community has fed to us.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's what I kind of worry about, actually, and is just like, our thinking about AI risk seems really binary. So on the one hand, you have like Silicon Valley doomers who are like, it's a risk of human extinction to humanity, blah, blah, blah. And like Jay, I think I'm probably like, I'm not fully bought into that. But I there are things like I worry about, like what happens if we hook up first detection nuclear stuff to AI. Like there are, you know, I think risks that we should be concerned about. So you have this one camp of doomers, and then you have another camp of like kind of anti-racist AI that is like, no, we shouldn't worry about existential risk. Like, that's a distraction. The real problem is inequality, algorithmic racism, etc., right? And there's something like kind of right about both of these accounts, right? Like what Kamala Harris is saying, like, that's absolutely right, an existential risk to whom? But then on the other hand, like, there are also, I think, these concerns that we can imagine, like, there might be real future risks, right? And I guess what I worry about is, it seems like right now we're in a place where the discourse is like, you pick one of these or the other, right? Like, you either think AI is going to exacerbate inequality and racism, or you think that AI is going to be a risk to the human species. And there's like not the both and argument, like that's totally dropped out of the picture. And I guess that's one of the things that, like, as an outside observer, really worries me, is that like both of these things are really important. And it seems really unproductive that we're in this space in the discourse in which you either like buy into one or the other of these kinds of risks.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think like a lot of the anti-racism, that camp, responds to the arguments that the AI safety camp makes to minimize those risks, because existential risk would always be greater. I interviewed Dario Mode, the CEO of Anthropic, in 2019 when he was still at OpenAI. And the way that he put it to me at the time was OpenAI at that point had GPT-2. So it was two generations ago. And they originally didn't want to release GPT-2 because they thought that was too dangerous to release into the world. And then there was so much backlash that from the academic community at the time, because no one really knew OpenAI beyond the AI research community, that they were like, you're OpenAI. Like, what are you doing? Why are you not releasing this model? Like, you should be giving this to the scientific community to study more if you think it's actually dangerous, so that we can get to the bottom of like how to make it not dangerous and so on and so forth. And so then eventually they turned around, they started releasing it. And the way that he justified it to me was, well, we didn't want to release it because we were worried about disinformation, and disinformation is bad. We're still very worried about that. But we've decided to release it because disinformation is not as bad as extinction to humanity. And if we release it now and get used to the technology at this stage, then that will give us that'll equip us better to tackle the possible, like, to prevent extinction from like more powerful AI. And that logic is like, you could say that for literally anything, because anything is not as bad as extinction to all of humanity.
100%.
So I think that's like what that camp, the other camp, is like, you got to pick one or the other, because if you pick the particular brand of AI safety that like uses that argument, then you are essentially saying that nothing else matters. But I agree with you that there is, I'm personally of the middle ground belief that a lot of the challenges of what we're going to see in AI, with AI in like the next decade or two decades or whatever, are going to be things that we can already ascertain based on how it affects people today in things like exacerbating inequality, or environmental impacts, like these types of things. We already have so much data and so much evidence about how AI is already affecting the most vulnerable communities, how it's accelerating different phenomena like information ecosystem erosion. If we actually just spend time using those signals to figure out how to build better AI, then we should, in theory, not then have to deal with a sudden superintelligence being horrible to people, because we've already figured it out along the way.
It's the inequality part of it. I think that Sam Altman's argument, basically, or at least when he gave to this guy that I know at Vice a few years ago, right, was that inequality will be solved because AI will lead to prosperity and less work, right? And that the sort of labor conditions will improve to the point where a lot of people won't have to work, and that what he advocates for is a UBI, right? Like a universal basic income that will solve all, which I don't know. I mean, I think it's an insane argument. It's one that Grimes made on Instagram, and then Grimes got kind of trolled because it was like that video where she was like, I have a proposition to the communists, right? And then she like makes this argument about AI.
They call it luxury communists.
I thought it was legitimately just Grimes saying this, but it was actually, it's like Sam Altman, you know, Sam Altman is also saying this. So these industry leaders are sort of arguing that it's this catch-all thing that if this thing works, then everything will be solved or everything will be destroyed, right? Like that's the basic tightrope that they're walking at all times. I had a question for you in terms of journalism, which is always, you know, we talk about it quite a bit on the show. I don't know if people like it or not, but you know, whatever, it's like shop talk. I had one experience where I tried to there was one instance where I tried to contact OpenAI, and it was right when three came out, or 3.5 came out or something like that. And I was like, all right, tell me how this thing works. I live in the Bay Area. I can just go down there. Let's have a chat, right? And it was very difficult, right? Like there was almost no transparency. I was curious about it. You're writing a book about this company, as you pointed out, and as we talked about in terms with our, you know, we had a guest on right before you. All this stuff is so opaque. They release Sora. They don't tell us anything about Sora. They just say Sora is cool, here's a couple videos that it made, right? But we don't know anything about it, right? We still don't know what the things that are really important for us to know, like, for example, what are the actual guardrails on OpenAI? Because we can see them. They've been discussed quite a bit, right? You can't ask it to generate anything about Hitler or anything like that, right? Those are done for very practical reasons that I think we can glean. But I want, like, it is important for people to know what the actual thinking of the people putting in even the most rudimentary, obvious safeguards are, because the larger safeguards, if we believe at all in the existential threat question, are much more important. And they won't even tell us the easy ones, like, don't make Nazi memes. You know. So what's the experience been like for you? I mean, it seems to me like I'm getting, like, stress reaction thinking about how difficult this book will be to report. I'm just like, oh my god, pick an easier book. Yeah, this is so hard.
I mean, OpenAI is notorious for being very closed off, and I did not make myself a friend to OpenAI pretty early on. I was the first journalist to ever profile them. I went to their offices in 2019, and then I published the piece in 2020 for MIT Technology Review at the time, and they were extremely...
Oh, I read that piece. It's great. Yeah.
They were extremely upset with that piece, and they, like, blacklisted me for 4 years, and then they slowly rewarmed up to the relationship when I had to start writing about them again for the Wall Street Journal, because they were like, you're at the Journal, we should probably talk to you.
Oh, that's cool. You get that. That means they're more open than most NBA teams, which will just blacklist you forever. And they're like, who cares? What's a Wall Street Journal?
Yeah. And well, it's been interesting because they are very hot and cold. Like sometimes they're like, we really want to work with you closely. And then other times they're like, we're going to give you interviews. And then they don't give me interviews for three months. Right. And it's kind of this back and forth and back and forth. And I think so much of AI reporting in general, like I've been covering AI for 6 years now, and I talk about this a lot with like other fellow travelers on covering this technology over the last few years, is that it's turned into an investigative beat. Like you cannot do this, you can't cover this technology anymore without just doing investigations full on.
I know, you're FOIAing like a data center. I was like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just that's like, what I was like, oh boy.
For two basic numbers, like, and I only found an estimate for one. Like, it's like the state of transparency is just incredibly sad. And like, you know, OpenAI would say they would say, like, well, they do actually spend a lot of time with journalists, but, you know, of course, they pick and choose their journalists. They get to pick and choose the journalists because every journalist in the world is knocking on their door get access. And when I used to be at MIT Technology Review, it was really funny because there were two of us that covered AI, and they would only ever send the press releases to my other colleague. Other colleague, I mean, he was like, they need to stop doing this. So he would email them and say, hey, I can't write about this. Please contact Karen. And they would send him back, oh, no, you see, we have a history. So we would strongly prefer to work with you.
Really? That's interesting. That's such a power play on their behalf. It really does feel like sports teams right at this point, you know, where they feel like they can just control the dictates of who gets in.
Exactly.
Because maybe they can, right? Maybe they're right about that at a certain extent, right? Because they can just, like, at the very least, they can just be like, oh, we'll just release this to, like, some popular podcast, right? Or a Substack or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, if I were their PR person, I would do exactly the same thing, right? Like, if you have the entire slate of every single journalist in the world that wants to write about you and get access, of course you're going to, you have to already pick and choose. So why would you pick the ones that are critical?
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's your pitch to OpenAI. If you need a new comms director and you want Karen to go away.
There you go.
There's a
cool tune of 800,000.
I think you should have a higher number than that, you know, but still think of a number. Oh man, I'm excited about this book though. I mean, like, is it the whole history of, is it the, so it's the history of everything, you know,
is the history of the company, the inside story, all of the characters.
Oh man, that's gonna be a bestseller. That's like, that's the, I mean, I don't
have a
but that's like the most, that's like, I don't mean this in any type of derogatory term, but that's like the most clear book that people will want to read. You know?
Yeah, I'm stoked.
I can think of all these rich dudes I know around here, if they're in the airport and they're like, oh shit, there's a book about, they would buy it immediately. Oh, much more so than like a kind of memoirist history of like an Asian American identity or something like that, you know,
which I loved.
Like, no, thank you. But it's not a book that even I, if I was standing in the, I would think I would pick your book before mine. That's cool. All right. Is there any, Tyler, do you have any other questions?
No, I think this was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll have you back. We talk about AI quite a bit, or at least I do. I think about it a lot just because it's, I don't know.
It's the topic du jour.
I know. Yeah. Also just like, I'm not convinced that like our brains are really that good, you know, like, that's basically the way that I just don't believe it. Like I look at some of the writing that I did earlier in my, you know, like when I was like 25 or something like that. And it's just so derivative, you know, but then I read it, I'm like, they're pretty good, you know, but it's like, it's basically, I'm just operating as a shitty language model. And then that's probably true for every thought that we have. Right. Yeah. And so then I just,
your training base just gets larger and larger.
Yeah, but then there's corrosions, right, as well, right? You know, certain parts of my brain just are not accessible to me anymore. In fact, I think everything's narrowing down. It's like now it's going to be like the Pow Pow Fish, Peppa the Pig, and like, you know, soccer training videos for 8-year-olds or something like that. That's all I intake these days. So
it's so funny because I have a friend who, she studies like the history of kind of like the intersection between computing or technology history and neuroscience, and she said this to me like years ago, but I found that it has rung true since then, like that when there are new models of computing, like back then there was like memory versus cache files or whatever, like long-term storage versus cache files, like we as humans have such a desire to adopt that model to describe our own brain. So like back then, neuroscientists who were trying to understand memory just like took the way that computers worked and were like, maybe this is how memory works, and then like ran with that. Yeah. And now we're doing the same exact thing with large language models. It's really interesting. And so I personally try to, I don't think that our brains work like large language models. I'm trying to like resist this metaphor, but
you're saying I'm a narcissist. That's just, but like, no, but that's super fascinating. What's in, like, what's the name of this friend just so that people listening can read up on this? Like, cause that's a super interesting, or that the idea, it's so interesting. It's like, and it also kind of makes sense that of course we would in a narcissistic way just apply our own brains to whatever new technology came out and then you know, come up with wild extrapolations based on that information.
Yeah. Well, she's it's Lan Li. We used to room together. She's a professor at Rice University. She actually she now does she does many different things, but it was like a something that she told me years ago when we were roommates where I was like, oh my God, this makes me completely rethink so much of like how we describe our brain. Yeah. Just
yeah, absolutely.
These metaphors are just really powerful from computing. They're so simple and easy, and it just makes sense. And because they are inspired off of us, we just think, oh, if it's maybe that we're all the same thing. But I actually don't think that were like large language models in maybe there are some mechanisms that are similar, but one of the things that we do as humans is we have intent and we can deliver meaning into our words, and large language models do not. They're just text prediction.
All right, we can have a longer conversation about that next time. All right, well, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you all for listening to the show. We do this every week. If you'd like to contribute and help us keep running the lights on, here it is, $5 a month at goodbye.substack.com or patreon.com/goodbye.